Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is Season 2, Episode 17. You are listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, we will have two segments. First, I am going to share some top-level findings with you from our latest Women in College Coaching Report Card. In the second segment, we'll hear again from my fellow disruptors on the latest disruption to the male-dominated model of sport. So 2 weeks ago, the Tucker Center released our annual Women in College Coaching Report Card in collaboration with WeCoach. And what this report does, if you're not familiar with it, is every year we document the percentage of women in coaching positions of women's teams in NCAA institutions. In this particular report card, we did all coaching positions. Yes, all coaching positions of all women's teams in NCAA Division I. Let me tell you, this was no small undertaking. We had a team of graduate students and undergraduate students on the Tucker team collecting this data last fall, and it took us nearly a year to clean it up, analyze it, and write it up for this report card, which, if you're interested, you can download free of charge on the Tucker Center website at tuckercenter.org. And I would really encourage you to do so because we went deep into the weeds, into the data, and we had some really cool findings. And we also released a lot of collateral material of infographics, tweets, and other social and digital materials on our social platform. So you can see that at Tucker Center on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. So with that said, you can check out all this data for yourself firsthand by going to our social, digital, or our website. So here are the key findings. This is our ninth year of doing this report. So we have a lot of data every year, but we also have a lot of longitudinal data that we're really starting to see some interesting trends. So first off, the percentage of Division I head coaches went up again for the eighth year in a row and is now at 42.3%. Yes, it did go up. It went up 0.2% up from last year when it was 42.1. So you might be saying, yeah, that's really not statistically significant and it's not going up very fast. That would be the glass half empty. However, the data is trending in the right direction, but you're right, it is remarkably stagnant. And we have a lot of work to do to get that number to go up a little bit quicker than 0.12 or 3%, which is about what it does every year. So that's just for head coaches. What we learned from the data, because we did grad assistants, we did assistant coaches, associate coaches, and head coaches and directors of sport. This was a big data set. We had nearly 11,000 records in this data set. And what we found, which was similar to the first time we collected all this data in 2012 of all positions, because normally we just do head coaches. As the position gets more lucrative, powerful, and visible, from grad assistant to assistant to associate to head to director, there are fewer women. And if you took this all the way up to athletic director, those percentages are even smaller. That is troubling because it tells us that coaching is a gendered occupation. This is not new knowledge, but this is data that helps confirm this long-standing trend. Now, the good news is there are some leaders in the landscape for the percentage of women head coaches of women's teams. Our institutional leader, and if I had a drum roll, I would do it, is Tennessee State. They had 85.7% of all their women's teams being led by a female head coach. They get an A. We had 18 A's out of 352 institutions. 18. And to get an A, you have to have 70% or more of your women's teams being led by a female head coach. There are way more F's than there are A's. That's where we're at. Okay, for the conference leader, for the second year in a row, is the Ivy League, with 52.4% of all their head coaches being women. The sport leader, interestingly enough, is an NCAA emerging sport. Wrestling, they had 100% women head coaches of women's teams. Now, you might say, well, that's not very interesting because there aren't that many programs. But this is a trend we've found over the years. Sports that are emerging, equestrian, rugby, beach volleyball, and now wrestling, tend to start with a very high percentage of women head coaches. Now, over time, those percentages have been going down, but at least initially, when we start new sport programs, athletic directors tend to hire women. So that is an opportunity. That's a target of opportunity for women to get in the game and hopefully to stay in the game. Okay, so we've also been tracking over time who leaves the position and who gets the position. We call this the gender coaching pair. So if a male head coach leaves, retires, is fired, takes another job, moves on, and they hire a woman, that would be a male-female gender pair. Now, in this particular Division I women team sample, there were 442 head coach positions that turned over between last year and this year. Out of those 442, 52.7% of the time a male was hired. Now, a male most likely replaced another male. But we also had females leaving positions and males getting hired. So this is why this statistic of 42.3% of all head coaches are women is stagnant, because the majority of hires being made by athletic directors and athletic departments are men. Now, until that statistic turns around, we're not going to have this number of women going up fast. So those are targets of opportunity. So we had 442 targets of opportunity, and over half of those, the target of opportunity was squandered and a male was hired. Now, I'm not saying that men shouldn't coach women. I've never said that, and I never will say it. But it is important that our female athletes, our elite female collegiate athletes, have the opportunity to have a same sex, same identity female role model. We know this matters from the research. And I've said it on other podcasts. We talk about it in the report card. I've talked about it in other research I've done. I've talked about it in women's sport coaching book. So it's out there. We know what the data is, and the data tells the story that our young women need confident, strong, visible female role models. Next key finding. Starting at the assistant coaching position, men are statistically and significantly older than women and are more likely to have children. But as soon as men and women make the jump to the assistant coaching position, men are statistically older about 5 years older than their female counterparts, and that age gap is pretty similar as they move to associate and head into director positions. We need more research to understand why this is the case and what factors are going into this age gap, because if men are entering the assistant coaching position older and have more experience, I would assume so if they're older, then they're already having a jump on their female counterparts for possibly being promoted and retained. So this assistant coach position, what we've titled, is the critical zone of attrition in the career pipeline for women. Now, it's possibly due to a lot of variables, but it is really clear to us that assistant coach is where the pipeline is leaky. And in this report, we identify that really clearly. So this is also an opportunity for policy, support, and programming to keep assistant coaches in the game, to keep women in the game. So much more to be done on that. So if you're listening to this and you want a pathway to make a difference, providing programming for assistant coaches is front and center. Now, the last couple findings that we found were really interesting that I'll share. And there's a lot of findings in the report, so please do look at it. I'm just sharing with you some top line here. Is very few coaches at any position out of 10,697 positions that we looked at. We go in and we look at the online coaching bio. That's how we code our data. We code position, we code sex of the coach, we code their age, we code their family narrative. And in most online coaching bios, you'll read the whole coaching bio and you get to the very bottom and there is a family narrative or there is not a family narrative. And a family narrative might say Bob Jones and his wife Mary and their three children, Billy, Betty, and Bobby Jr., live in Minneapolis. So that's a family narrative. So it's really, really common. Some coaches don't have a family narrative, and that might be by choice, or they might not have a heterosexual family narrative that they feel comfortable sharing. So for all the coaches in the sample at any position, director of ops, grad assistant, assistant, associate, head coach, director, 42 of 10,697 coaches openly identified as gay within their online biographies by indicating a same-sex family narrative. So for example, it might say Mary Smith and her partner Heather live in Minneapolis. Only 42 coaches, and most of them were head coaches, have a same-sex family narrative. So what that tells me, that is a really, really, really small percentage. What that tells me, based on the data, is that homophobia is alive and well and prevalent within college athletics because many gay coaches do not feel comfortable being their authentic selves in their online coaching bio. We have a lot of work to do. Colleges, heterosexual men with children. Coaching, like many occupations, is gendered. Much work remains to ensure that all women, regardless of their identities, feel safe, valued, and supported. So the Tucker Center is committed to working collaboratively with other researchers, with other organizations, with other institutions to ensure and work with those in power to make sure that all women who want to coach and desire to coach and would like to stay in coaching feel safe, valued, and supported. So please check out the report card. And Next, we will hear from my fellow disruptors. So stay tuned and we'll be right with you with our disruptor segment. You won't want to miss it. Guerrero and Dr. Katie LaBelle. Disruptors is a campaign and a movement that highlights disruptions to the normative model of sport, a model created by and for men and that privileges men. Disruptors, we hope, draws attention to the people, organizations, and events that disrupt the status quo. Welcome to my fellow disruptors.
I've been noticing more and more sport retail stories coming up under the umbrella of disruptions. And just in this past week, I guess there were kind of two, I guess the yin and the yang of disruptions. But the first one that really bugged me was the Australian National Women's Football League, the Westfield Matildas. They released their new team kit sponsored by Nike. And in a fun twist, they announced that the away kit would not be available in women's sizing. And so they got slammed for this on social media, and they ended up issuing a statement that it was essentially an apology for the inconvenience. And they assured supporters that the issue would be rectified, and the next kit that was due out in 2022 would include women's sizes for a women's sports team. And I guess I can maybe couch this announcement that it's on the heels of the week before that, the Irish national rugby team released women's kits using nameless models instead of the actual female athletes on the team. Right. And then, of course, over the summer, we've got Sabrina Ionescu's jersey selling out almost immediately. Diana Taurasi's GOAT t-shirt a couple of weeks ago sold out in less than a minute. There was no gear available for the Washington Mystics after they won the WNBA championship. So we're starting to get a real list of these issues. And so the other side of the story this week came from a piece in Forbes that was highlighting Under Armour's success in their women's and girls categories. And Under Armour last week, they launched a new women's basketball shoe and a new, they're calling it the M plus M1 line of leggings. And what's really cool about them is they're both designed specifically for women athletes with cool new technologies that are innovative specifically for women's athletes. And so I guess the innovation or the disruption here is that when you invest in women's athletes, the sales go up, surprise, surprise. And so Under Armour, the article in Forbes, noted that their sales had gone up 77% from January through to May versus a year ago. And their e-commerce sales are up 214% in the first quarter of this year. So that's pre-pandemic. And the online sales of their full price girls items are up almost 50% as well. So full circle disruption, I guess. One of the key challenges in the women's sports space has always been showing that women can move merchandise. And I think Under Armour's numbers here are really significant because they show just that. When you invest in women's products, consumers are noticing. And the array of sellouts also start to build a real narrative of demand, which I think is the other part of this conversation as we try to move brands and properties to do a better job of anticipating purchase behavior in this space.
Yeah, and I think to piggyback on that is that consumers are also noticing when sport brands are not providing merchandise. And so there's sort of a chicken or the egg here that's really starting to emerge very clearly.
Yeah, I mean, the sportswear market's on track to be a $200 billion a year industry. And all of the key forecasts are naming women as the next key consumer base. So it seems like Under Armour seems to get this. They're investing in the untapped market. They're seeing a return on their investment, which is key. And I guess for brands and properties, this isn't just evidence of a disruption. It's evidence of a successful disruption.
Because, you know, as you know, the retail space in sport management has really been overlooked and there's not been enough research in this area. And it makes probably the strongest case of all for the economic viability of women as consumers in the women's market. So, I mean, I love that you're noting this. Just on sort of a personal level, I got the emails from Nike last week launching their maternity clothing line, you know, which we noted as a bit of a disruption in the past, but again, prompted because of the athletes that they did not, they didn't treat appropriately, who then, you know, became disruptors in the sense that they let Nike know that they were actually going to stop being Nike asset athletes, you know, so Nike's been responsive in that way. But I think it's interesting, as you're pointing out, that Under Armour is now jumping in a bigger way. And it certainly appears as though Nike doesn't care that they keep missing the mark on demand, because this is repetitive and consistent, and it's just inexcusable from an economic standpoint that the demand continues to be unmet. I don't understand that.
Yeah, I mean, with Nike, I think a lot of their advertising is performative. They've got the performative marketing and advertising, but then when you actually start to look at the products offered, they're missing the mark a little bit.
A big bit. So one of my disruptors for the week is Asia Wilson. She was named MVP, and of course for the Las Vegas franchise, she was Rookie of the Year her first year, and then she's MVP her third season, which is pretty incredible.
But the first thing that I noted is, spoken like a true season ticket holder of the Aces, I might add.
Yes, absolutely. 100%. 100%. Very proud. Yes, but also the first thing I tweeted was, I want that t-shirt. So for the longest time, I've wanted the Nike t-shirt that says Las Vegas basketball. It's the one that all of the athletes wear, right? And you can't find it. It's just not available. And same thing with the sweats, you know, and all the gear that the athletes wear. That's what people want to purchase, but it's just not accessible for us. In fact, the t-shirt that did become accessible when Asia was named MVP was actually launched by the Players Association. Wasn't the WNBA, wasn't Nike, it was actually the Players Association. So I found that quite interesting as well, that at least there is something that we can purchase in support of her, you know, new status. But again, Nike seems to be missing the mark, even though she is a Nike asset athlete, and certainly the WNBA isn't stepping up there either.
America to the world of big wave surfing. I don't know if y'all caught the article that came out last week with Maya Gabriera, I believe is how you pronounce her last name. So here's what's interesting to me about this one is we're starting to see now more people talking about sports where women and men can compete. They do the exact same thing, right? It's not a different distance. It's exactly the same. So big wave surfing is that, although it scares me to death what they do.
That video is insane.
Insane. So the story is they once a year in Portugal, they can ride these waves that are 70 feet high. If you just think about that, 70 feet high or more. And so this year, it appears two women, Maya and a second place finisher in the women's, both rode a wave higher than the men's winner. Yet what was interesting about this is what they do to women, right? We're competing head-to-head with men, although in different divisions, but the exact same wave. They subjected her wave to extra scrutiny. They had outside people measure it to make sure it was the right height, and they got it correct. They didn't do that with the men's winner. They announced the men's winner and let him be the big wave surfing champion when it comes out that she's surfed a wave that is 3.5 feet bigger than his, as did the second place finisher in the women. They both beat the man, but they put them through this extra scrutiny, right? That there's no way that they could have done this. Let's measure the wave. Let's do all this. So to me, that sort of shows two things. One, huge disruption. These women have learned to take on men. Like at the exact same way they do this sport, and they show no fear, which I love. But here's the other side of it. When you're a disruptor, you're going to get a lot more attention, and they push away the media that she could have got for the initial announcement of the big wave down the road and still give the spotlight to the men. So a disruption, but also we're seeing how they're going to start to deal with these disruptions, right?
So what's interesting to me about these disruptions today is that it's both and. It's both a disruption and there's backlash, pushback, taking steps backwards. And so I'm wondering, you know, how many steps forward do we really have to take to make real progress when the marginalization, the silence, the erasure, the lack of gear, the inability of people to see the marketplace sort of counters the disruptive element of what these women are doing. And I think with surfing, it's interesting because they were a sport recently that instituted equal pay
right
for their championship athletes, which was really a disruption. But then they go and treat the female athlete differently. So it's just this both and constant. Can it be and?
Well, I agree. I mean, think about how much money she potentially lost with that pushback, right? That extra time to announce, because I'm sure that brands came out in support of that man that they named as the big wave surfing champion, and he got all the attention. So she not only lost attention in media, she lost potential income, right? Mm-hmm. So you're right, where she took a big step forward. She's a disruptor, but the disruption caused such a backlash.
And I think it goes right back to what Katie was talking about, where, I mean, our job continues to be putting the data out there to show them that the demand is there, that the market is there, because just as Anne just said, you know, the value that both of those women could have not just received themselves, but offered to the industry, the surf industry, right? The problem is that those who are in control don't see that. They continue to go to that default, as we've said a million times. And they think that the male champion is the only one that has any economic viability. So we have to continue to show the data that indicates, like, we have this market and you're not tapping into it. You're not meeting the demand. I will, though, Nicole, I do like to keep the positive top of mind. And so with the Asia story, I think there's a little more from, again, a Las Vegas perspective, but she was featured on the moniker of the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Resort and Casino on the Las Vegas Strip, which is a very, very prominent featuring. Now, of course, that's where they play, but it's notable because tonight the Las Vegas Raiders are launching their new season in a $2 billion stadium, and that's what everybody's talking about, right? So to have Asia Wilson featured prominently on the Strip this weekend is in fact a very significant shift in my mind, because we're giving attention to the women's professional team in town and directly competing in some ways with a very established, you know, NFL team.
Anybody else have anything they want to add or build on each other's disruptors?
It is on us as researchers to really start flipping the narrative by using the data and teaching a new story in a lot of ways. Let the data tell the story, as you always say, Nicole. But I think that's so important at this particular juncture right now, because you can, I mean, we're getting more and more evidence to point towards not only a market for women's sport, but, you know, showing the untapped revenue options that are around the product as well. So I think the more that we can let the data tell the story and try to reshape the narrative, the better.
If you use the data for Asia Wilson, I think they tweeted out there's only one male NBA player who's matched her numbers. When people came at her saying, oh, who cares what she's done as an MVP in the WNBA, and they said there's one player in the entire NBA who's matched her output in all the statistical categories or exceeded it. So she's in a pretty elite category, and at least those data is telling the story for her.
Yes, and we do like data to tell the story. So that's why we have this disruptor segment, because we do want to change the narrative. We do want to disrupt the status quo, and we have to rely on data. And that is our job, in my opinion, and I think the three of you would agree, that as scholars, we have to be public scholars and get off the bench and out of the ivory tower and into the communities that we work and share what we know, so we can invite everybody else to join us in disrupting this space. So that's the end of our disruption discussion of sport for today. Tune in again for the disruptor segment of Tucker Center Talks. And please join us by drawing attention to disruptions in sport that disrupt the male-dominated model or that benefits women's sport of female athletes by using the disruptors hashtag in your social media. Thank you. Check out our website at tuckercenter.org and follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram. You can find the show notes with links and resources for this episode at wisports.com. Look for the Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab, where you'll find many more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.